Cameraman.
She don't want to pick. She's on the mic.
Layla, you
she's the boom. Go ahead.
Of course.
Go ahead.
One summer evening, I went to a meeting in the Bronx. It was late July, and Pedro had been locked up in Rikers for almost exactly a year. The steady drumbeat of press that Manny had orchestrated for him was getting louder. And in the Bronx, the case had become a rallying point.
Oh, but I was wondering, how can we put together like a big, massive rally in front of Bronx Supreme Court? And hopefully we could do it in the next 2 weeks, man.
A group of community activists were gathered in a law office above a bar. They were trying to figure out a way to raise the funds to bail Pedro out.
He has to be out before...
Pedro's mom, Jessica, was at the meeting, and she spoke about how his experience had changed her family.
That my daughters, I have a daughter in college right now for criminal justice in John Jay College. So we believe in the justice system. And then to turn around and the system failing us, it's like double the hit. We're getting hit by the justice system, and personally, the fate we had in it, like, hurts. So,
one by one, everyone in the room shared stories about their own experiences with the justice system.
How you doing? My name is Jason, and I'm formerly incarcerated. I also myself served 17 years straight. I was incarcerated at the age of 16. Wow. I'm like, you came out at the age of 32 and did 8 years on parole.
Most of them had spent time in prison, and they all had things to say about the way they'd been treated by cops and prosecutors.
The DA don't care if you're right, wrong, innocent, or guilty. They only care about their quota and what they have to meet.
As I was standing there listening to everyone go around the circle, I heard footsteps on the stairs. The door opened, and a stocky guy in a double-breasted suit walked in. It was Manny. For a while, he just stood off to the side, quietly watching. But Manny's Manny. I knew he wouldn't be able to stay quiet for long.
Like, our kids are fucking traumatized by police officers, and no one is dealing with that.
Well, that's where you're wrong. Someone is dealing with that. Somebody does care, and it's me. I'm Manuel Gomez. I'm the private investigator of the Jessica Perez family. I'm saying hello to him. Okay. All right?
Manny stood in front of the crowd, wiping the sweat off his forehead with a salmon-colored pocket square.
And that's why I'm here. Because I've been an army of one that I've been kicking your ass left and right. All right, are you going to walk with me? Are you going to knuckle up with me? Or are you going to let the suit and tie fool you?
The other people were looking up at Manny with expressions of surprise and curiosity. Who was this sweaty guy in a suit? And what did he want? By this time, I'd been following him around for a year and a half, and I still wasn't sure. I did know it wasn't just about Pedro, wasn't just about Terrell. I'd come to realize that it went deeper, back to a time before Manny had ever heard of Pedro or Terrell, back to a time when Manny was the thing he's now fighting, a cop who felt the police department betrayed him. From Gimlet Media, I'm Saki Kanafo, and this is Conviction. To understand the origins of Manny's fight against the NYPD, it helps to know about some of the fights that came before it. Manny was born in Puerto Rico and was raised by his mom in the South Bronx, not far from where Pedro lives now. They lived on the Grand Concourse, a boulevard lined with stately buildings that, by the 70s, were falling into abandonment and disarray. If the Bronx is tough now, it was even tougher then. There were a lot of gangs, and back then Manny was small and scrawny. He says he got picked on a lot.
I had to learn the hard way and not to take shit. And you had to fight, because if you didn't fight, they'd beat the shit out of you more. So if they knew you were going to fight back, you were able to get respect in the street that way. So it was a school of hard knocks.
In Manny's actual school, things weren't much easier. He says he was diagnosed with dyslexia and placed into a special education classroom. He says his teachers thought he was stupid, told him he'd never amount to anything, but not his mom.
And she would constantly tell me, Manuel, a man who sets limitations has limitations. Do you have any? No, Mom, I can do anything. Are you afraid? No, Mom, I can face anything. And then if I said I was afraid, she smacked me in the head. She said, stop that shit. Your name is Manuel Gomez. You are not to be afraid.
After graduating from high school, he joined the military, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, eventually became an intelligence officer in an anti-terrorism task force. One day, when he was home on leave, something happened that would shape the course of his life. Something that would eventually lead him to Pedro. At the time, it seemed like nothing.
I was coming back on a train, and I was on active duty. I had a $3 military haircut, you know, the shaved sides, you know, and I looked like a jarhead, you know. I had my military jacket, you know, like the Top Gun flight jacket, with the Ray-Bans and so forth, and I'm sitting in the train station waiting for the 6 train to come by. This cop kept looking at me in the platform. I get on the train, he gets on the train, he walks up to me, goes, hey, you look like what somebody we're looking for. I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm Sergeant Manuel Gomez. I'm an intelligence sergeant. Here's my ID. I'm just came off active duty. Here's my bag and everything. And he goes to me, well, we need you to come with us. Now, being from the Bronx, you don't tell a cop no.
Manny followed the cop to the precinct, where he says his supervisor quickly realized they had the wrong guy.
And he goes, same jacket, but this is not the guy. And I said, that's what I said. I'm not the guy you're looking for. So the sergeant goes, sorry for the inconvenience. Have a great day.
Manny walked away, didn't give it another thought. He went back to the military, spent a couple more years in active duty, and then came back to the Bronx, where he applied for a job as a cop.
They hired me. I was in the academy, being the best I could be. I was in the top 10% of the academy. My grades was 95 average. And what happened? They turned around one day and they says, hey, you got to go down to personnel.
He'd only been in the academy for 2 months, but there was already a problem.
They sat down in a room with a lieutenant and a captain, and they says, you're being terminated because you omitted information on the application. I said, excuse me? What information did I omit? He says, an arrest record. I says, I'm a military intelligence officer with the nation's highest clearance. I have no arrest. What are you talking about?
What they were talking about, Manny says, was that one afternoon 3 years earlier when the cops stopped him on the train, brought him into the precinct, and then released him right away. Manny says the supervisors asked him if he had any memory of the incident.
And I says, yeah, I got stopped on a train. Some cop said I fit the description of somebody. He took me into the 17th precinct. I was never handcuffed, photographed, or fingerprinted. So that's not an arrest.
Actually, to the NYPD, it was. Even though the cops who stopped him that day knew he was the wrong guy, they'd entered a record of the incident into an arrest database. And then they sealed the record so that only law enforcement agencies could see it. Manny says they never told him about it. But now, 3 years later, he was getting kicked out of the academy because he hadn't disclosed it. He'd been accused of lying about an arrest that he claims not to have known about, and that should probably never have happened in the first place. Manny was shocked. He says he'd been taking a class in the police academy on the Constitution, and he began quoting the Sixth Amendment back to the officials, arguing that all citizens have a right to be informed of the charges made against them, and that the police had violated that right.
So I told him, I says, you know what? You're not going to strong arm me. All right? I'm going to go and take care of this. All right? You both guys can, you know what? Go fuck yourself. So I...
because, you literally said that?
Yeah. I says, you just fucked with the wrong guy now.
Manny could have walked away. Could have said, hell with it. This isn't worth it. I'm not going to work for a place that doesn't want me. But if there was one thing he learned growing up in the Bronx, it's that you never let anyone stand in your way. Doesn't matter if it's some kid in the streets or the New York City Police Department. When your name is Manuel Gomez, you are not to be afraid. You fight back with everything you have. And that's what Manny did. First, he joined forces with a group of Latino officers who were suing the department over discrimination. They called themselves the LOA, the Latino Officers Association. As part of the lawsuit, they filed a Freedom of Information request to the police department to see if the department had done the same thing to other people that they'd done to Manny.
What Manny uncovered was a systemic problem in the system that maintains records on thousands of people, unbeknownst to them.
This is Anthony Miranda, the head of the LOA. Miranda said that Manny was far from the only person in New York who had a bogus arrest on his record that he'd never been told about. In the course of gathering information for the lawsuit, Miranda and Manny found that this was common practice, disproportionately affecting Black and Latino people.
So mostly minorities, mostly in your poorer communities, right? That's what you had, people who couldn't defend themselves. Nobody wanted to admit to what was going on here. So Manny's fight was to bring attention to it.
Manny says he wanted to do something to help all those people, and maybe even more than that. He wanted to stick it to the police department. So despite his lack of legal training, he set out to write a law that would make what they had done to him a crime.
You know, the Ghostbusters Library on 42nd Street in Madison, the big lines? Well, I freaking just went there. And I walked in and I never forget, I went to the librarian and I says, excuse me, I don't have a library card, but I want to know how to write a law. Can you tell me what book? And they looked at me and laughed. And I says, no, seriously. what do I got to do?
Manny says he spent long days at the library, plowing through a pile of books. And after 8 months, he drafted a bill requiring police departments throughout the country to destroy all their records of voided arrests. He called it the Clear Your Good Name Act. And he convinced a bunch of prominent lawmakers to sponsor it. He managed to get a lot of coverage for his crusade. It was his first intoxicating taste of media attention.
I was on the radio telling people how to get a copy of the voided arrest, and I was telling them how to find out, trying to help people so we can put an end to this.
The bill died in Congress, but in 2001, after 3 years of battling the NYPD in Congress and in the media and in court, the police department offered him his job back. This time, he made it through the academy, got to go to the graduation ceremony, and he says it was one of the best days of his life.
I had my blue shirt, blue pants, on my brand new black leather, my 9mm, you know, and I was just, everything was polished, and I looked like I came out of like I looked like a wooden soldier, perfectly glowing. I was so happy. I was the proudest guy in the world. You would have thought I was freaking General Patton walking in, you know, with 5 stars on my chest. I was so happy.
Even after everything he'd been through, even after this 3-year battle against the department, Manny thought he finally had a bright future in the NYPD. But Anthony Miranda, the head of the LOA, wasn't so optimistic.
When Manny got his job back, he was really excited and he felt like he was starting over with a clean slate.
Yeah.
Was he?
No. Police Department is not forgiving. Not forgiving. Everybody who filed in the class action lawsuit, their names were on it. If you look up their names, they have a special mark on their names in the police department. Everybody who filed a claim. So you're always being monitored as one of those participants.
What do you mean a mark?
Like they kept files on all the people who filed lawsuits so that you were part of a class action lawsuit. But whether you won the laws didn't matter because you were part of the class action. So they keep that on your record. So in your file somewhere on their internal systems, there was a special indicator saying that you were part of the class action lawsuit.
I looked at Manny's file, and it's true. The very first page notes that he took part in Latino Officers Association versus the City of New York. If any of his commanders looked at his file, they would have immediately seen that he was part of a high-profile, controversial battle against the department. And sure enough, Manny says, on his very first day of work,
I got there and I stood in formation, and then I was in a room with about 42 other cops I didn't know from nowhere. And then I must have been in the precinct maybe about 30 minutes. And then the sergeants came in, lieutenant came in, the inspector of the precinct came in. He's looking around, and then he looks at me. And then he goes, oh, yeah, an Army officer guy? You're that guy. Aren't you the one that sued the department? You know, I mean, he said it in front of everybody. Like, oh, you're one of those LOA guys. This is how it starts.
The NYPD says, quote, as a matter of policy and practice, retaliation is and has always been prohibited by the department. But in Manny's telling, his supervisors started retaliating against him right away. In a lawsuit he later filed, he says that he was quickly assigned to a dangerous post, the stretch of Wheeler Avenue, where a 23-year-old man, Amadou Diallo, was shot at 41 times by cops who mistook him for a suspect. There was a mural at the site depicting cops dressed up like members of the KKK. It was an emblem of the neighborhood's outrage and frustration with the police. And Manny says he had to patrol the area by himself.
literally, I would walk down the block, and sometimes people would throw, you know, either a bottle from a roof or a plate of food, or, you know, I've had an air conditioner thrown at me at one time. It was like, you know, it was severe punishment, and it was to have something happen to me, because they knew the chances of me being hurt on this spot and being a rookie was like 95%.
Manny was convinced his supervisors were out to get him, and that might have been true. But if it was, he wasn't making it hard for them. He was giving them ammunition to use against him. In his first year on the job, civilians filed a lot of complaints against him, 9 altogether, accusing him of harassing them or threatening them with violence or using excessive force, among other complaints. One complaint says Manny stopped 2 guys without cause, threw them against a wall, and threatened to break one of the guy's teeth. Someone else accused him of saying, "I'm glad your friend's son was run over by a car." Reading these complaints was disorienting. I'd always known that Manny could be brash and aggressive, a fighter, but I'd only seen him fighting prosecutors and cops. Now I could see that he had certain things in common with the cops he hated, cops like David Terrell. Manny says most of the people who filed complaints against him were criminals who were just angry that he arrested them. But Terrell has claimed the same thing. Manny also notes that the department later cleared him of these complaints, which is true. But again, most of Terrell's complaints didn't lead to any guilty findings either. There was at least one key difference, though, between Manny and Terrell. In Terrell's case, the civilian complaints against him didn't stop him from getting a special assignment in gang intelligence and a promotion to detective. For Manny, it went a different way. His supervisors were constantly on him, admonishing him, putting him on performance review, sticking him on desk duty. Eventually, the Latino Officers Association was awarded a settlement in their discrimination lawsuit, but Manny didn't want to settle. He wanted to win. He filed another complaint against the department, claiming they'd retaliated against him for being part of the LOA lawsuit. When he told Anthony Miranda that he'd filed that second complaint, Miranda had some words of warning for him.
"So everything they have, they're going to throw at you." And I told Manny that. I said, "You got to be extra careful right now. Right now, that means that the game is on, right? It starts now."
Just a few days after filing that complaint, Manny was driving down an abandoned street at the end of his shift.
All of a sudden, this minivan is like beeping the horn, beep, 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 and coming at me. Now, I'm like, what the hell's going on? So I pull over. The guy gets out the car, comes at me with a bag, goes, "Officer, officer, I found this bag."
"What kind of bag?"
Like a paper bag, like you would put like a bagel in.
Okay.
So I'm like, you know, asking this guy, like a cop's supposed to do, you know, "What are you stopping me for?" And he goes, "Oh, officer, officer," and he looks, you know, he goes, "Can you take the bag?" I'm like, "What am I going to take the bag for? I don't know what's in the bag. You open it."
The guy opened it, and Manny looked inside. It was filled with little plastic bags of white powder. Looked to Manny like heroin. Manny says the guy was nervous, wouldn't look him in the eye. He was dressed like a utility worker, and he had some convoluted story about how he found the bag at his work site. Manny didn't believe him.
So you're looking at it, and walk me through what's running through your mind.
What I was thinking was, this guy's Little League, and he doesn't know what the hell he's doing.
So you already thought he was a cop?
I knew it was.
Manny was convinced the guy was an undercover cop. He thought the guy was working for the police department's internal affairs bureau, and that the whole scene, the drugs, the minivan, the utility worker getup, the guy's weird story, they were all part of something called an integrity test, a procedure where internal affairs agents try to tempt officers into doing something corrupt. Manny knew what he was supposed to do to pass the test. According to the department guidelines, he was supposed to take the drugs from the guy, bring them back to the precinct, and hand them to a sergeant who would voucher them for safekeeping. But Manny didn't think that was a good idea.
You were concerned that if you took it by yourself and vouchered it at the precinct, what would happen?
Oh, most definitely they could have said, "Well, something was missing," or, "We gave you 10 bags and you only vouchered 7 or 8. Now, you know, you would have had me. You would have had me in a trap where I couldn't have gotten out of. See, so my thing was, you're not going to set me up."
Standing there on the street, trying to figure out how to get out of this bizarre situation, Manny says he had an idea. He would bring the guy with him to the precinct. And that way, Manny wouldn't have to touch the bag, and no one would be able to claim that he'd taken anything out of it. But the guy refused to go with him.
No. I don't want to do that, officer. I don't want to do that. And I'm like, listen, what do you mean you don't want to do that? And I'm looking him in the eyes. His eyes are everywhere. So I'm like, okay. I said, what command do you work for? And I says, I know what you're doing. You know what? The fuck out of here. I know exactly what you are. And you're not going to set me up.
The guy turned around and got back in the van. When I first heard this story, I had my doubts. Did it really go down like that? Like a scene from Miami Vice? As often is the case with Manny, the facts, more or less, backed him up.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2.
Officer, if you would, please state your name, rank, shield, and command.
Name is Manuel Gomez. My shield number is 7760. My command currently now is Guanas Autopilot, SSB.
This is a department recording of Internal Affairs Investigation 03-32315-CKC 03-01997. The voice you hear is an Internal Affairs official. Manny had been right. That guy with the bag had been an undercover officer sent by Internal Affairs to perform an integrity test, a test that the official was now questioning Manny about.
Yes, sir. Okay, so someone gave you narcotics, right? And when someone gives you narcotics, what are you supposed to do with that officer?
If someone gives you narcotics, you're supposed to voucher.
Did you do that, officer?
No, I did not voucher. I don't know. I'm not going to trust anybody come up to me in the street and say, here, I got a bag. I don't do that.
Manny was in a bind here. Again, he says he didn't voucher the bag, didn't bring it into the precinct, because he was worried that the police department would set him up if he did. But by not vouchering it, he'd violated department protocol. And that's all that mattered to the department. It didn't matter that he didn't take the drugs, didn't use them, didn't sell them. What mattered was that he failed to follow department procedure. His supervisors were building a file on him filled with incidents like this. Procedural violations that cops don't always get in much trouble for. But Manny wasn't just any cop. He was a cop who'd sued the department. And so he had to be more careful than most cops. There wasn't much room to make mistakes. Anthony Miranda, the head of the LOA, told me a lot of members of his organization had been in situations like this.
It's like walking a tightrope. You can't slip. Because if you slip, all hell breaks loose.
Coming up after the break, all hell breaks loose. When I first met Manny and he told me that he'd been mistreated by the police department, I had good reason to believe him. I'd spent a couple of years reporting on cops who'd been punished for blowing the whistle in the department. They'd accused the department of discrimination, or they'd refused to engage in practices that they believed were racist and abusive. And they said the department had retaliated against them, sending them on undesirable assignments, denying them promotions, giving them bad evaluations, ruining their careers. In one well-known case, a cop who blew the whistle on his commanders said his commanders had him forcibly committed to a psychiatric ward. But Manny's story turned out to be more complicated than most. As I reported on him, it became harder for me to see him as he seemed to see himself, as a hero. And one of the things that made it hard was learning about the incident that ended his time in the NYPD. A warning here, the story that follows may be upsetting to some listeners. One afternoon, Manny was in his convertible with a woman he'd been seeing on and off for about a year. They were driving down a residential street in the Bronx when they got into an argument and things got heated. According to Manny, she smashed a bottle of lotion on the dashboard. So he pulled over and demanded she get out of the car. Eventually, he walked around to the passenger side to pull her out. She later testified that he punched her in the legs while trying to pull her out. He denies this.
I grabbed her hand and pulled her out once. I'm strong. Pulled on, she got out. And then I closed the door. She was destroying the inside of my car. Car's brand new. And I have the right to pull somebody out of my car if you're trying to destroy my car.
He got back in the car thinking it was over.
I got inside the car, and as I was about to drive off, she punches in the back of my windshield, all right, of my convertible, and slices open her hand. It's bleeding everywhere.
My producer and I attempted to contact the woman involved in this incident several times, but were unsuccessful. But she did testify that this part of the story is true. She managed to punch through the car's rear windshield. She cut her hand and was bleeding heavily. She started screaming in pain, and it attracted attention. Bystanders began to gather. Manny got back out of the car and called 911.
911 operator, 223 emergency.
What's the address? What's the street? I need a police car at 921. What's the street?
Fucking
what's
Daniel,
the street?
Logan Avenue.
Logan Avenue.
911?
Yes, 911.
921 Logan Avenue.
921 Logan Avenue.
You can hear her screaming in pain in the background.
What two streets are you between?
There's paper in my car.
What two streets are you between?
Yeah. They're coming now.
Sir, what's happening? Hello? Hello?
Yes.
What's happening?
I need a police car.
Why?
At 921 Logan Avenue. And an ambulance.
Why, sir? What's going on?
I have a lady that broke my back windshield. All right? And she... No, her phone's right there. I don't have anything.
Sir, I want you to talk to me.
Say again?
Talk to me, okay? I need the information.
I need an ambulance. She broke my windshield, my back windshield, and she cut her arm.
While Manny was on the phone, a crowd had begun to form around him. All they saw was a woman bleeding and screaming, and a big, burly guy looming over her. And they drew the obvious conclusion that Manny was hurting her. Some of the guys in the crowd approached Manny, and Manny told them to back away. At that point, the call went dead. Manny says one of the guys in the growing crowd tackled him and knocked the phone out of his hand. He says they started a fight. Other people started calling 911.
Yeah, I need a police car. There's a domestic dispute here on 921 Logan Avenue. There's a big brawl, a girl, a guy, and the other guys are getting involved. Between Logan and Lafayette, please hurry.
Manny says three of his ribs were broken in the brawl. He says he was in too much pain to keep fighting, so he took out his gun, aimed it at the crowd, and told them to back off, said he was a cop. The 911 calls kept pouring in.
All right, they'll be there as soon as possible, okay?
It's a big thing. You better get someone in now. Someone's going to get shot.
Yes, sir. We'll tell them, give them all the information, and we'll try to get there as soon as possible.
In the commotion, Manny's ex-girlfriend began walking away, trailing blood. Manny saw her leaving the scene, and he followed. Manny handcuffed her an injured hand and brought her back to the scene. He claims he wanted to keep her there until the ambulance arrived, and he insists she followed him willingly, but it didn't seem that way to the people calling 911.
You know, he's coming right now with her right now. He's fucking dragging her back over here. They're coming back now.
Back at the scene, Manny shouted at everyone that they were under arrest.
And I was just naming charge after charge after charge after charge. He's under arrest. These four guys are under arrest for inciting riot, obstructing governmental administration.
Finally, the cops arrived. But they didn't arrest the people Manny wanted them to arrest.
So now they go to arrest me. And now I'm put up against a car with, you know, six cops. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? I'm a police officer. I just called you.
Manny was charged with assault and a laundry list of other offenses. He says he spent the next 5 days in jail, first on a prison barge in the East River, and then at Rikers Island. After he got out of jail, his ex-girlfriend wrote two letters to the Bronx DA. In the letters, she said she didn't agree with the charges against Manny, and she asked the prosecutors to drop the case against him. The prosecutors did eventually drop the case against Manny, but Manny's time as a cop was almost over. The police department held their own administrative trial, where he was charged with 8 acts of misconduct, like preventing the woman from leaving the scene, and pointing his gun at the civilians who tried to intervene, and failing to properly identify himself as a police officer. Some of the civilians testified against Manny at the trial, and Manny testified too. He argued that the civilians had attacked him, forcing him to behave the way he did. And he said that he did identify himself as a police officer. If you listen to the 911 calls, it does sound like he's saying, police, back away. Manny can point to a number of times in the hearing when the civilians contradicted themselves or each other. But the judge sided with the civilians, saying that they were more credible than Manny. And so, for the second time in his career as a cop, Manny was kicked off the force. In case after case of police misconduct, police departments throughout the country are faced with a choice. Who to believe, a civilian or a cop? Talk to people in the South Bronx, and they'll tell you that they're rarely believed, that the police department routinely goes with the cop. That's what the NYPD did with Terrell for 15 years, promoted him, in spite of all the claims that people were making about him. But Manny's case was different. And knowing what I know about the police department, I don't have trouble believing that one of the reasons the department treated him differently was because he'd sued them for discrimination. Still, it's hard to believe Manny when he tells me that he behaved exactly like he was supposed to that day, that he didn't do anything wrong. It wasn't the first time he'd been in a domestic dispute. During my reporting on him, I would eventually learn of three other incidents where the police had been called to deal with a report of a domestic incident. In two of the cases, when the cops showed up, the woman said they'd just been arguing. But in the third case, according to court paperwork, Manny ended up pleading guilty to harassment with physical contact. When I asked Manny about those incidents, he insisted that he was never violent. He claimed he pled guilty in that one case just so he wouldn't have to spend time and money coming back to court. He never admitted fault, and he never expressed regret. And he never expressed any regret for how he behaved in the incident that got him fired either. He didn't regret putting handcuffs on his ex-girlfriend, didn't regret keeping her at the scene, didn't regret pointing his gun at the crowd.
I mean, they would have came at me, I could have killed all of them. I mean, I had 50 rounds on me and two guns. What does that tell you? Actually, not more than I had 15, 60 rounds on me. All right, so I could have, you know, if it would have got to that level, but I showed restraint.
Do you understand how, like, some people might hear that and, like, not see that it showed restraint?
What do you mean? I had three broken ribs. I had to pull my gun out to say back up. I kept saying back up. As a police officer, they wouldn't listen. I was attacked.
I'm just curious, like, do you realize how people could just hear this, like...
Mm-hmm, sure.
Just hear that you got into this like crazy like altercation. Then you say like you could have shot you could have like committed a massacre on the street in the Bronx. And the fact that you didn't shows restraint.
Yeah.
Some people might hear that and just not think restraint. But you have to understand something.
I understand what you're saying. And I agree with you. I agree with you 200%. I mean, if anyone else wants to say that was maybe too aggressive, how is it aggressive when I'm the one calling for help, when I'm the one reporting the scene? Somebody else would not have been reporting the scene. It happens all the time. Cops get into off-duty domestic incidents. They don't call the cops. They get jammed up. I called.
When Manny's challenged, he never backs down. He fights back harder. That's the lesson he learned as a kid. And it may have helped him then, but it wasn't helping him now. In the judge's written decision, he noted that cops who'd gotten in trouble for similar things didn't usually get fired. But he said that Manny deserved a, quote, higher penalty than most officers. Partly that was because of Manny's disciplinary record, a record that might well have been the result of retaliation. But it was also because of what the judge called a complete lack of insight into the inappropriate nature of his action. After he was fired, Manny says he applied for security jobs wherever they were accepting applications. He says they all turned him down. No one would hire a fired cop. But there was one way forward. As it turns out, getting thrown out of the police department for misconduct does not disqualify you from becoming a licensed private investigator. Manny was back in the criminal justice business, only now he was on the other side. He didn't have the police department's rules to worry about or any bosses telling him what to do. At first, he took all kinds of PI work. He says he tailed cheating husbands, worked as a bounty hunter, arresting people who'd skipped bail. And then, not long after he was fired, he got a different kind of case. A case not unlike Pedro's. The client was a 21-year-old named Inger Javier. He'd been in Rikers for 2 years on a murder charge. The cops said he'd fatally stabbed someone on the street outside an auto body shop, but he insisted he was innocent. Manny could tell from Inger's file that there was a surveillance video from the street where the murder took place, but the video had never been turned over to Inger's lawyer. So Manny set off to get his own copy. He says one of his first stops was the auto body shop near the crime scene.
Nobody would deal with me. Well, Mexican, Spanish, Puerto Rican, Dominican, but they wouldn't deal with me. They just was really terrified of the cops. So I went to McDonald's. I bought $40 in freaking value burgers. All right. I went across the street. There was a liquor store. I got me 2 bottles of Brugal rum. And then I got me a 2-liter bottle of Coke. I went back there. So now they're drinking burgers. They're eating. After about 30 minutes, they're playing the salsa music. Now he's got about 5 or 6 drinks in him, the manager. And I says, listen, is there any way that I could look on the computer? And he goes, yeah, no problem. Come on over. The video from the night of the murder was still on the computer 2 years later.
One way or another, Manny did get his hands on the video. It showed a group of kids chasing after the victim with a knife, while Manny's client stood off to the side, uninvolved, holding a soda cup. Manny brought the video to the prosecutors, and the prosecutors dismissed the charges. I talked to Manny's client and his brother at their home, and his brother said, Manny saved our family. After that case, Manny's reputation spread. People whose kids were in trouble with the law began calling him and asking for help. And Manny began thinking of himself as a bringer of justice for the innocent. But it was never just about justice.
They can't touch me. They can't hurt me. Because they see that I'm unstoppable. Because what I present is the truth.
So it's payback.
Oh yeah, it's payback big time. It's payback in spades.
Manny wanted vindication and vengeance. But how far would he be willing to go to get it? On the next episode of Conviction, his hunger for payback leads him to make some risky decisions. Decisions that could save Pedro, or that could get him into even deeper trouble. Conviction is a production of Gimlet Media. It's hosted by me, Saki Kanafo, and produced by Meg Driscoll, Chris Neary, and Saeed Tijan Thomas. Our editors are Alex Bloomberg, Jorge Just, Lynn Levy, and Jessica Weisberg. Mixing by Sam Baer and Haley Shaw. Music by Haley Shaw. Our credits music is Hard Times by Curtis Mayfield, performed by Baby Huey. This series was developed with help from producer Kate Osborne, and it grew out of a collaboration with the New York Times Magazine. Special thanks to my editor there, Mike Benoit. The series was also made in partnership with Type Investigations. Special thanks to Esther Kaplan and fact-checker Evan Malmgren. Thanks also to John White and Sarah McPhee. I'm sick and tired of having so many hearts.